Okay, so let me start and welcome you all to the monthly conference call from the Society of Addiction Psychology. This is Mark Shanker, and this is part of our monthly series on clinical issues related one way or another to addiction treatment. A couple of preliminary comments. One is, if you discuss any case material, be aware that the call is going to be recorded, and you'll be able to access it later. So please be careful about anything you say in terms of confidentiality. Second thing, extremely important, press the mute button on your phone so we don't get lots of background noises. I will take this opportunity to announce that our next two calls, completing out the year, November 8th, Ed Kantzian from Harvard will be speaking about the disease concept of, the self-medication concept of addiction. And on December 13th, Matt Johnson from Johns Hopkins will be talking about psychedelic therapy. And with no further ado, I'm really pleased to be able to introduce Donald Meichenbaum, who's an eminent psychologist in our field. He's a retired distinguished professor emeritus from the University of Waterloo in Ontario. He's currently the research director of the Melissa Institute for Violence Prevention. He's considered one of the fathers of cognitive behavior therapy, and he's been voted, quote, one of the 10 most influential psychotherapists of the 20th century, end quote. He's been working in the substance use disorder field and has trained nationally, internationally, and everywhere. So I will hand it over to you, and you can take it and ask questions or whatever as you go along.
Right. Well, thank you, Mark, and thank you for all of your folks' interest and attention. Let me, moreover, commend you on your good judgment in being here. This is as timely a topic that we as a society face. Permit me to just take a few minutes to put this presentation in some perspective, give you an outline of where I'm going, and indicate along the way where I'm going to pause for your feedback and questions therein. I will start with the intro that Mark offered. I taught at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada for 45 years and then took early retirement and became research director of the Melissa Institute for Violence Prevention in Miami. And I will invite you, as a supplement to this presentation, to visit that website. That's www.melissa, all one word, institute.org. And if you go /scientific-articles-by-author, you can also scroll to my name and see a number of additional follow-up presentations. In fact, a keynote address there on how to avoid relapse in maintaining treatment effects, especially with regard to opioid users. So that presentation will nicely supplement the handout that I put here. Secondly, this is a very timely presentation for me because I have just finished a book on treating individuals with addictive disorders, a strength-based approach. It's a sort of a patient manual. I've been involved in consultations for treatment centers on addictions for the last 25 years, and most recently in Canada at a place called Homewood. And they have treatment centers all across the country that I've spent the last 2.5 years visiting and consulting on, and as a result of all that consultation have put together this presentation. It's actually a condensation of a 5-day workshop that I'm going to squeeze into this 1 hour, so sit back and hold on. And I also have been involved in putting together a book on Roadmap to Resilience that deals with returning soldiers and have been involved in assessment procedures for smart recovery. So that's the backdrop of where this presentation is coming from. I'm going to try and deal with five particular topics. One is a consideration of what works. I've included in the handout the Appendix A to my book, which reviews some of that, and I want to sort of make sure we're on an even playing field from my perspective. The second kind of notion is I want everyone who's on this phone call or going to hear this to realize that they're not only Homo sapiens, but they're also Homo narrans. A homo narin is a storyteller. And what I'm going to do is try to address the nature of the story that people tell themselves from a kind of constructive narrative perspective on how they convince themselves to engage in addictive behaviors. And I'm going to review quickly some of the research that led me to this constructive narrative perspective. Third, I'm going to present page 8 of the handout here. And that has a case conceptualization model that I'm going to walk you through rather quickly. And I'm going to do more than that. I'm going to reduce your entire professional career to one page, if I'm able to succeed in that. So when people ask you what it is you do for a living, you're going to be able to give them page 8. And moreover, you see the implications of that for treatment. I'm then going to consider the outline of what I've included as the core task of what makes someone an expert therapist. So after each of these particular segments, I'm going to pause and see if there's any particular feedback and invite you at your leisure to download the handout or write Mark for a copy of it. In fact, the last two pages, pages 59 and 60, gives you a summary of the 10 chapters for the patient handbook. I'm actually speaking to you from Cape Cod, where I'm for the summer, and we're in under northeaster condition. We're under stormy conditions of wind and rain and so forth, but I'll try and talk over that coming through the windows. Okay, so once again, thank you for your attendance and interest. In putting together this first topic of what works, I was heavily influenced in the book, and this is chapter 8, by the recent book by William Miller and Forsheims and Zwieben, a really good book, which is their second edition, and also a book by Judith Grisel. If you haven't seen it, I recommend it. It's called Never Enough. She's a neuroscientist who had a severe addiction problem and is now a professor looking at the neurobiology of addiction at Bucknell University in Pennsylvania. And what I took away from their work and my experience is that if you look at the variety of treatment alternatives, and here I did a training of all the addiction counselors in the province of Nova Scotia, and they asked me what is it they should embrace. And my reading of the literature, and I wonder if it concurs with your own, is that they're essentially distinctions without much of a difference, that if you look at the variety of alternative procedures, whether they're cognitive behavioral or 12-step or inpatient, outpatient, and so forth, there's essentially no winners to the race. But what stands out that becomes interesting to me, because we've trained a number of therapists, is that some therapists are just a lot more effective in getting long-term lasting changes than others. And it, as people highlight, it's the who administers the intervention rather than the specific kind of treatment that is offered. In fact, we've been training people to use feedback-informed treatment, apropos of Miller, Duncan, Lambert, and others, where you get session-by-session feedback from the client and then are able to collaborate and alter your intervention in a tailored fashion that is both culturally and gender-specific in its format. So what becomes interesting to me is how do we get lasting changes? What is it that leads to people not only to tend to improve but to maintain it? My understanding is that in the aftermath of treatment interventions, 75% of folks will relapse. So the name of the game is how do you help people take away from whatever you offer in your treatment, whether it's an individual or couples or residential, how do you help them become more critical consumers and also apply? So what I'm going to walk you through is my game plan on what you need to do to achieve these kinds of long-term impact, that maintenance of this. So if you get a chance to look at Appendix A, you can start to see the role that these processes play. The interesting issue if I'm having any kind of merit, and I'll comment on this and then pause, is I've come to the notion that we're all storytellers. I spent 40 years trying to develop evidence-based cognitive behavioral interventions. In fact, I wrote a book called The Evolution of Cognitive Behavior Therapy, which sort of summarized all the work we did on stress inoculation, on cognitive restructuring, on self-instructional training, and other kinds of skills interest. And we've also focused in on the issue of treatment non-adherence and how to get maintenance across time. And as I worked in that domain, I became more and more impressed with the quality of the nature of the therapeutic alliance playing maybe 3 to 4 times more important than the specific treatment intervention. I also took to heart the notion of the adage that substance abuse, like alcoholism, is 10% drinking and 90% thinking. So I'm going to focus in on what is that 90% and what are the implications therein. What is the nature of the mindset? So in being influenced in this particular perspective, I have been heartily attentive to the work of Miller and others in terms of motivational interviewing, and their notions that change talk is an important predictor of outcome. In fact, there's a set of studies by Taylor and his colleagues at the University of British Columbia when they interviewed recovering alcoholics and asked them critical questions, and I review this in the book, critical questions about when they were tempted and how did they resist and when they fell off the wagon, supposedly, and then how did they cope? And it turned out that the answers that they used that were bathed with change talk, that were bathed with metacognitive executive verbs, that were bathed with RE verbs, you know, I'm going to recover, I'm going to renew, I'm going to regain, that the answers to their questions were in fact predictive of which people had long-term recovery. That is, the stories that people tell themselves and that they tell others are indeed a critical mediator. In fact, I often spent a long period of time attending AA meetings and listening to the nature of the recovery stories. I was able to put together for the book a set of websites like Crisis Next Door and others that include the accounts by people who have actually recovered. They may have lapsed and then picked up and gone further. But if you listen to the language that people tell themselves and tell others to justify, to rationalize, and the like, I've been able to pick up what gets people stuck and what gets them unstuck. So one of the things that you'll see on page 12 of the handout, and I'll only go through this rather quickly so we can get some dialogue on it because I'm really interested in your folks' own experiences, I came up with a mnemonic called defenses. In fact, I had to use the English spelling of the word defenses. So it was D-E-F-E-N-C-E-S. I needed a C. English, in England, they spell it with a C as compared to an S. So let me give you a feel. And as I go through this, think about some kinds of clients you've seen and how do they convince themselves, as well as significant others, that even though they know the behavior that they're engaging in is potentially self-injurious and potentially even fatal and has a significant impact on others, what is the nature of the stories that people tell when pressed on engaging in this? How does it convey the sense of helplessness, the sense of addiction, and the like? So the D here is the degree to which a person initially engages in some form of denial. And these are not mutually exclusive. You know, it's just, alcohol is legal. I mean, marijuana, you could just smoke it. You know, I'm not really an addict. I'm only a social drinker, okay? E, they have a kind of evaluative view of themselves, that they hate themselves, that they're messed up their whole life, they berate myself. It's you know, there's an enemy within, the power is too great, the F is fatalistic, I'm helpless, I'm hopeless, I'm powerless. Okay, if I can control it, I would. Any kind of effort is useless on my part. I've tried multiple times. What am I doing? I'm trying to get into the head of people who are convincing themselves that they should engage in substance abuse, or in fact, this may be applicable to other forms of addictions as well. You know, whether it's internet or gambling or sex or food or shopping, what have you. Think about some behavior you should be engaging in that's health-related, and think of all the reasons why you're unlikely to do that. I'm going to talk about that in a moment. Right now, I'm walking you through this mnemonic of those elements. So the D, as I indicated, was denial. E was self-evaluative. A was fatalistic. The other kinds of ways that I become an exquisite listener to how people talk to themselves and others has to do with evaluative thoughts of others. This is a way of getting back at them. You know, they hurt me. You know, I feel alienated, marginalized. I'm a burden on others. No one really cares. You know, it doesn't give a shit. I'll be able to do this. The N stands for needs belief. This is the kinds of I need it. I just need it to unwind. I need this as a way to cope with my pain. I can't survive without it. If I use X, I'll be just more sexy. I'll be able to endure life. I'll be able to feel less guilty, ashamed. I'll tell you what it is all about. It's the C. You know, I can control this. I'm not like the others who can't handle their booze. You know, whenever I want to stop, I can stop. And you know, not only that, you ready for this? I'm entitled, okay? I deserve this kind of drink. You know, I can't be happy without it. You know, I really need this to just cope. You know, I work my butt off, and this is the way. You know, I'll tell you, it's just so good. The buzz is so high. I know I need more and more of this, but I'll do whatever it takes to get there, okay? So what you find is, and I'll be real curious to your initial reactions to this, is if we look at and listen to the clients, we can start to see the degree to which they engage in these kinds of behaviors. In fact, in our book on treatment non-adherence, we actually identified three class of reasons why people don't engage in health-related behaviors. In fact, you can even perform a personal experiment on yourself as I go through this kind of thing. That is, think of some health-related behavior. I do this in workshops all the time. That you think you should engage in. You know, I should exercise more. You know, I should eat less. You know, I should go for a colonoscopy. I should floss my teeth. So if you just write down some health-related behavior that you personally should be engaged in, and if you write down all the reasons why you do not do this, I'm going to explain exactly what your answer is going to be. You fail to engage in health-related behaviors for three major class of reasons. The first is people engage and they are sort of doubting Thomases. They question the scientific validity of engaging in this behavior. That is, they question whether compliance in a health-related behavior or the changing for in the behavior like will make a difference, okay? So if we take smoking, for example, you know, they point to examples of where people continue to smoke and they live long and healthy lives, you know. They point to data, like Jim Kick, right? He did all that exercise, had a heart attack, died like that. My sister, okay, she smoked during the entire pregnancy, and nothing bad happened. That she didn't have, look, she had that whole mouth. So my doctor smokes, okay? So one of the reasons why people fail to comply with requests, from my perspective, is they act like doubting Thomases. They act like scientists who question the validity of whatever happens. The second reason that I suspect you will add to your list of reasons is you act like an economist. You weigh the pros and cons of engaging in a specific behavior. That is, if I give up smoking, I'll gain weight. You choose your own poison. You know, the only way I get high with my friends, okay, if I give up the drugs, I'm going to lose all that. I'll be flooded by the flashbacks, okay? That the pain is, I'll tell you why, okay? I drink, I eat, I do this stuff to avoid withdrawal symptoms, okay? So they act like an economist who weighs sort of the pros and cons of engaging in the behavior. There is a third class of reasons that we've been able to identify as to why people are failing to comply. And that is, the major reason there is they have a set of deep-seated beliefs, a fatalistic, we're all going to die anyway, so I hate people telling me what to do. You know, I am in charge of my life. So they have these kinds of belief systems that color the way in which they have a mindset. In summary, in putting together the book on strengths-based approaches to this, I tried to enumerate the variety of mindset that people engage in. A, how do they convince themselves to use substances? And that was summarized under the defense mnemonic. Secondly, what are the reasons that people offer when they drop out of treatment, when they begin the habit again? And I'm going to suggest that those three categories, and you could point to the papers that I have on the Melissa Institute that sort of supports this perspective. If there is any merit to this kind of constructive narrative perspective, and note that these are hot cognitions, you know, so emotions and cognitions are two sides of the same coin. And these kinds of thinking processes contribute to payoffs for the person, as noted in my defense mnemonic. So permit me to pause and take this opportunity to glean your reactions to both my evaluation of the state of the art in terms of the role of therapeutic alliance, the role of feedback-informed treatment, and my constructive narrative perspective, because then I'm going to take you through what are the treatment implications so that we can get more long-lasting changes. Thanks for hearing me out, and I await any questions or feedback.
Dr. Meichenbaum, this is Bruce Leese. It's good to hear you. Thank you for doing this. I have to tell you before I ask a question that my fondest memory of you is a talk you gave 100 years ago. I think it was in Europe when you described how you formulated your first ideas about cognitive behavioral therapy around the dinner table with your Jewish mother. It was something to that effect. Do you remember that?
Not only that, in the book on the evolution of cognitive behavior therapy, the first chapter is how my mother discovered cognitive behavior therapy.
Okay, you've just sold another book.
No, that's fine. I actually just listened to your lecture on this, so.
Ah, well, I hope it wasn't too terrible. So.
No. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Yeah, it's a question. I so appreciate what you've shared so far and that you're dipping into this field. I am curious about a lot of the thoughts and narratives we hear in helping people with addictions are like you described, but a lot of them are also really mundane and just have to do with, you know, very short little sentences that don't expand beyond, you know, I'm just going to do it. It's not that I hate myself or that my life is miserable, or it's just, you know what, I'm going to do it. It's
right.
What I do. And so if you would just comment on, you know, kind of the spectrum from very severe negative thinking to just kind of utilitarian narratives that don't say much about suffering or character or anything like that.
So for a second, you be the patient, okay? And I'll be the therapist. So if you said, I just do it, okay, the first thing that I would be prone to do is to pluck out what the it is. So tell me, what is it that you do, okay, so I could just better understand what we're dealing with. So what I'm going to do is, you know, and you know, I have videotapes when I do workshops where this is comes up. You know, so what I'm going to do is not merely accept I do it, but I'm going to use the art of questioning to try and ascertain what is it that you do. And then what I'm going to do is, how did you come to do that? You know, I'm not going to be judgmental. I have to develop a therapeutic alliance to get you on by that. And when other people ask you, for instance, about your doing it, what questions do they ask? What do you say? Okay? So even though the person is giving what you call a utilitarian limited response, I'm not going to merely accept that and see if I could use the art of questioning to do that, you know, to get them to explore what I think is much more going on at that process, okay? And if you're going to do it, how do you know when you're going to do it? What are the kinds of triggers that are there, okay? So the first important element is how to develop a therapeutic alliance with that person so that you can compassion. And if he's going to do it, why is he in your office? What does he need? What is it that brings him there to tell you this? Okay? So, you know, I'm a therapist who is going to take whatever clients give me, okay, commend them. Not only that, I would, you know, one of the things I do clinically is I would say, what a relief, you know. When I ask people this question, one of the things they do is they go on and on and give me explanations. What a relief is having someone in front of me who just says, I do it, okay? That is, there is nothing that a client gives you that you can't reframe as buying into treatment. I'm not sure if I'm getting close to modeling how I would get into what I consider is much larger, like those defense kinds of things or the reasons why people are noncompliant. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
You know, no, so, you know, this is what I call the art of therapy in order to engage in that process. Let me see if there are any other questions or comments that people have before I take you to the case conceptualization model.
I'm Ann Wallace, Dr. Garbo, and I'm in Lancaster, and thank you for your presentation, Dr. Eichenbaum. Can you talk about maybe the difference between someone very earnestly saying, no, I'm going to quit, I'm picking up that day, or I set myself a deadline, and genuine change talk?
Okay. I'm getting a little background noise there from someone, so I want to make sure I got your question. So you have the person is saying what to you, ma'am?
Saying, I'm quitting. I'm not going to use anymore. I've set myself a quit date. I've told so-and-so. What distinguishes that kind of arbitrary quit date kind of talk from genuine change talk?
So one of the things is, once again, my perspective is you have to go for the chain of thinking processes that led that. So one of the things I would be really prone to do is to ask the person, how did they come to the decision to do this? What are the kinds of challenges that she finds in following through on that? So to answer, one part of the answer that I would give is how I would respond to that therapeutically, okay? The other kind of thing that I listen for in terms of change talk are the degree to which the client takes my voice with them. In fact, one of my favorite questions to ask clients is the following. Can I ask you something a bit different, a bit unusual? Do you ever find yourself out there in your day-to-day experience asking yourself the questions we ask each other right here? Now, that's a really clever question, because what you want to do is put yourself out of business and have them anticipate the challenges that they're going to have when they meet their due date. Because one of the things we know is that 75% of people are going to relapse in the aftermath of their stopping. So the key question is, how can they take your voice with them and actually use that in this process? So insofar as they give you that opening, that is the occasion for you to use the art of questioning, some of the motivational interviewing kinds of procedures, in order to have them consider how they could extend whatever they've taken away from your sessions that they could apply down the road. So the whole name of the game is not getting people to stop. It's how do you reduce the likelihood of lapses escalating to the point of relapse. Okay, and as noted in the handout, I have included a variety of interventions, not only the art of questioning. I've also included there, as you'll see in the handout, the degree to which you get feedback, the way in which you do collaborative goal setting, the way in which you do psychoeducation, how do you assess strengths, how do you teach skills and not only teach them, but how do you build in generalization, how do you build in relapse prevention, and the like. So engaging in those kinds of activities becomes really important. The other item that hopefully you'll have a chance to look at is if you want lasting changes from clients, there's a real need to put them in a consultative mode. So they have to enumerate what is it they got out of treatment and what are the reasons why doing this will be important. Not only that, how much self-confidence do they have? Can they anticipate barriers? So my concern is that when people leave residential treatment centers where I've consulted for years, you don't get any lasting changes. So if you kindly have a look down the back of my handout, what we've done is put together a series of checklists that people need to share with us. So there's a patient checklist, there's a 12-step AA checklist, there's a recovery checklist. So what we do is we ask clients, in order to get lasting changes, to say, look, we've worked with a number of folks like yourself, and we've asked them, what, if anything, did they get out of the treatment? What would make a difference so that the kind of efforts they've made here, they'll be able to apply out there? Could you, the patient, kindly take a moment and go through this list? Now, as you go through the list, each person's unique. Each person's different. Now, as you go through the list, is there anything on this list that you have learned, that you plan to use, and put a check mark there? In fact, is there anything on this list that you're not using that you may want to consider adding? And finally, here's my most important request. Is there anything that you've learned while you've been working with me that's not on the list that with your permission we could add? Now you could see inherent in this strategy that there's a lot of therapy. So no matter what technique you use, I don't care if it's mindfulness training or relapse prevention or whether it's couples therapy or what have you, the bottom line is we know that nothing sustains itself over time. So insofar as I can get, have you, the client, share with me, take ownership of the skills, and offer self-generated reasons why you're going to do it. Insofar as I could build in relapse prevention, insofar as I could get self-efficacy ratings, insofar as I could provide booster sessions, ongoing case managers and the like, you increase the likelihood substantially that people will show improvement. Not only that, how do you increase people's awareness? So in the book that I put together, there are separate chapters on how to deal with emotion regulation and how to deal with cognitive rethinking skills and then what's interpersonal skills you need. What's the spiritual changes that you need to engage in? What is it that you're taking away that you now own? I need my clients to become tutors to others. So my message is, given the fact that we have this particular story that's getting in the way of their interventions, then the interesting question becomes, how do I get you to take my voice with you? How do you get them to become their own therapist? In fact, there's a kind of strategy we use called a clock metaphor that you'll see that has them appreciate that any situation they encounter is like a clock, 12 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 6 and 9 o'clock. And 12 o'clock are the external, internal triggers. What are the kinds of thinking processes? At 6 o'clock, what's the emotion? So we have people appreciate how they inadvertently, unwittingly, and unknowingly start to contribute to the very kinds of relapses that they've given. I'm sorry to press on so much, but I really wanted you to sort of explore.
No, I'm looking at your handout now and seeing all the things you're talking about, and they're very helpful.
You know, the other thing that's in there that's kind of neat, before I get to close off with the case conceptualization, is I went to see this movie, Beautiful Boy, with Steve Carell. You know, it's the story of the father-son that was a dual book. And in that movie, they have a thing where Carell goes up to a residential treatment center and tries to find out whether it's a good placement for his son. And one of the things that happened is I have a good friend whose son was addicted. And she asked me, given my work, what treatment center would I be interested in suggesting that she send her son to? So rather than answer her question, I said, I'll put together a letter for you that you should send to the medical director of any residential treatment program you're considering, or any therapist that you're considering. And you should send this letter off to the person. And how they answer that question will determine where you should send someone to. So included in your handout on page 54 is the letter I gave this woman. Okay? And in fact, a number of treatment centers are now using my checklist of the 23 questions that should be addressed. You know, and I wish I had the opportunity to have written the script for Steve Carell, because he could have gone in and said, I'm thinking of sending my son here. Could you please answer these questions for me? And on the answer to these questions, I will choose whether it's a good setting or not.
I just want to interject. Could everybody check that they have the mute button on? Here in the background. Back.
Okay, someone is playing music for my background. That's nice.
Ready, check.
I will press on and talk over that.
Talk loud.
Okay, I'll talk loud. So this is my last thing that I want you to take away, because I said at the outset, I'm going to reduce your entire career to one page. And that one page is on page 8. Is this loud enough, Mark? Is that going to work? Mark?
Oh, I had my mute button pressed. I'm hearing you, but it is kind of cracked. Sorry about that.
Okay, I'm not sure where that music's coming for. But I will press on, even with the music as a background.
Okay,
so one of the things that you have in your handout is on page 8. So let me put this page 8 in context, because if you get to page 8 of the book, of the handout, you're going to see 9 boxes. So this was a challenge. When I worked, consulted for Homewood, and they have treatment centers all across the country, one of the things that became interesting is that we, at the center place in Guelph, did not know how did other people across the country spend their time. So I put together a case conceptualization model that I will suggest is a useful way to analyze how people spend their time. So if I may, even with the music as a background, hopefully you can still hear this, I will walk you through these 9 boxes and tell you the treatment implications therein. So each of us as clinicians start off by ascertaining background information from the client, which I enumerated as 1A. You also ascertain what are the reasons for referral, how do people get there now, what are their presenting problems, what functions does it serve, moreover, how does it impact on their day-to-day functioning, in terms of interpersonal relationships, work-related, school-related, and the like. To what degree do they have comorbid disorders in terms of axis 1, axis 2, physical ailments and the like, and what impact does that have? What's the nature of the stresses that they have, and there are four kinds of stresses? What treatments did they receive? What do they have going for them? And then most importantly, box 6, what strengths do they have? Of these areas, where should we begin? How would we know if it's successful in terms of the goal attainment scaling, and what potential barriers are going on? Once again, I apologize for the music. It's not coming from me.
Don?
Yeah.
I am going to make a suggestion. We've got 20 minutes left, and I would like to make the best of it. This
hey,
is
Mark,
really, I think.
Mark. Hey, Mark.
Yeah, Bruce.
Mark, that's somebody's
I can't, Bruce, I can't hear you.
You can put everyone on you.
Bruce, I can't hear you.
Never mind.
What's your suggestion, Mark, about how to
My suggestion was everybody hang up and call back in again.
Okay, I'm going to reduce your whole life to one page, so it's worth calling back in.
It's worth calling back. Now, everybody call back in, and whoever's got us on hold will have to call back in.
All right, we'll call back
okay.
in.
Call right back in.
Right.
There?
Yeah, I'm here.
This is Lisa Lynn.
This is Chuck
Don. Don, Mike and Mel.
Yeah, hi, Don. I'm still hearing it. I'm so sorry. Hold on. Let me try something. Is that better?
Yeah.
It's gone.
Oh, now we got something else.
Hey,
Mark.
I think
Bruce.
It's the recording service.
Hey, Mark.
Yeah, Bruce.
That's somebody's phone music. They didn't hang up. So what you'll need to do is to experiment with your own mute button. See if you can keep Don on there and mute. See if you can mute them as the director of the phone call.
Well, I'll press mute, but it doesn't seem to.
I think it's the call-in service, not someone's phone.
This isn't their usual music. I mean, this is really distracting. Can we try to hang up and call back in, and I will wait 1 minute and see if whoever it is disconnects.
Right. I think that you may need to actually somehow end the phone call. Is there a way to end the phone call and then start it again?
That's what I thought I did, but
the music came back.
Just leave.
Well, listen, is this worth... I mean, the material is worth continuing, but is the distraction too much?
Well, I think it's absolutely appropriate that when we are talking about relapse and lapses, that in the midst of all of this, we get interrupted. Okay?
All right.
This is what happens to an addict all the time.
Talk
they're well-intentioned, they're on their way, and some surprising event occurs that leads to a lapse. Okay? So we could tell the people who are listening here that we have intentionally put the music on in order for them to appreciate what an addict has to go through.
See, and all you had to do was make that interpretation, and it went away.
That's what cognitive behavior therapists do.
Okay, well, back to the drawing board. I don't know how that stopped, but we're back.
No, I did that.
Thank you.
Hey, Mark, let's just remind people, whoever just got back on the phone from hold, whoever had their hold button on disrupted the call for 10 minutes. So whoever that is should please, please mute your phone. And when you push the hold button, we're going to hear everyone's elevator music.
Yeah. Okay, well, back to the drawing board.
Okay, so...
Sorry about that.
You know, let me summarize what we've been talking about so far. One is I started off by trying to enumerate from the work of Miller and Forsheims and Zwiebeln and Judy Grisel sort of the state of the art and highlighted the role of the therapeutic alliance, the art of questioning, feedback-informed treatment, and that there's no winners to the race. And who administers the intervention, no matter what the intervention is more important than the specific facts of what goes into the treatment. In fact, therapeutic alliance accounts for about 4 times more important in terms of variance and outcome than others. And this not only applies in the area of addictions, but when I lecture on what makes someone an expert therapist, I highlight this across all clinical domains. The second kind of thing is I tried to explain how I got to a kind of constructive narrative perspective with regard to understanding addictive behaviors. And as I became an exquisite listener to the way in which clients tell their story to themselves and to others, the fact that they're all homonarons, I came across this summary of their thinking processes in terms of this mnemonic of defenses. In fact, in the book, I enumerate the variety of reasons that people employ and use various substances or engage in other forms of addictive behaviors. And the more varied the reasons, the greater the likelihood of them having a severe substance abuse disorder and more likely to relapse. And relapse is the name of the game since 75% of people relapse. I then enumerated some of the work on expectation apropos of Goldman or Taylor's work on predicting recovery, long-term recovery, or the work on change talk apropos of motivational interview by Miller and Rolnick as contributing to that process. I then was trying to highlight some of the therapeutic implications of how one uses the art of questioning to get at the thinking processes and the accompanying emotions. And now looked at some of the reasons why people are non-compliant in terms of their reasons they offer themselves and others as sort of a doubting Thomas, questioning the validity, the degree to which they're economists looking at the pros and cons, and then finally sort of having deep-seated schema beliefs about fatalism or control and the like that undermine their not giving up their substances. We're now up to the final piece of what it is that I am trying to convey in this limited time, and that is, as I consulted to this center in Homewood in Ontario, Canada, they have clinics all across the country from Victoria, Vancouver, Edmonton, Toronto, Montreal, and so forth. And we wanted to ascertain, how do people spend their time? That is, when you go into your office and close the door, how can we figure out how you spend your time and what will be the differential outcome? In order to try and ascertain that information, I put together a case conceptualization that's on page 8 of the handout, if you're able to follow along. And what you will see there are 9 boxes. Each of those 9 boxes you could view as a screen on your computer. It'll have 1A, 1B, 2A, 2B, and so forth. They each cover a specific category. In fact, if you are statistically minded, you could look at each of these boxes as a kind of beta weight in terms of predicting multiple regression equations and contributing to who lapses and who doesn't. So one of the things I'm going to do is walk you through this, but one of the things I will propose to you is that there's nothing that you do for a living that we cannot code. So, for example, if you went in and said, you know, as I look at this, I am a 2A, 5B, 6B guy, 9C. So if I said to you, what does it mean that you are a 2A, 5B, 6B, 9B guy? You know, and one of the things that would happen is if we go back to my page 8, that means that you spent your time in that session trying to handle some of the presenting problems that are dysfunctional for the person. Not only that, you would try to figure out in terms of 5B whether you have a history of treatment non-adherence that I need to anticipate and address. Moreover, I could not do it alone because I would need some social support, which is highlighted in box 6. And finally, I need to understand whether there are particular barriers. These are social barriers, people who are enablers, people who are codependent, and so forth. And if, in fact, we are successful down the road, what I'm going to do is spend my time looking at 4C, that is, developmental history of victimization, and therefore I may need to use some kind of integrative treatment, apropos in the Javits or Kloytra or Ford, rather than just doing parallel interventions. Look, here is the bottom line. I am going to propose to you that you take out page 8, and the next time you attend a case conference, and keep in mind, Neil once wrote an article called Why I Never Attend a Case Conference. In fact, we recently with Scott Littlefeld, we wrote an article on how to spot hype in the field of psychotherapy. In fact, I'm proud to say that the journal Psychotherapy chose our article as the best article of the year in the field of psychotherapy. So next time you attend a case conference or write up progress notes, take out page 8 and see the degree to which people tell their story of their clients in this kind of systematic fashion. And not only that, no one should come to the table without box 6. You know, I've been training cognitive behavior therapists for a long time. And one of the conclusions I came to is that the major reason that cognitive therapy works, its modus operandi, is that it helps to prevent depression in psychotherapists. So, in fact, if you are getting depressed on the job, it's because you have not embraced this kind of perspective where you have to pull out strengths. You have to identify the person who's beyond the addiction, behind the diagnostic label. So imagine that you, after this, have someone tell you that they have a client who they've been saving. Since you spend your time listening to these lectures, we've saved a beaut for you. You will not believe this woman. She is off the wall. And not only that, wait until you meet her husband. Then you'll understand why she uses substances so much. And I'm not even sure she's going to follow through. And once you get a list of the history of her victim, so one of the things that you could do is to say, excuse me, to your colleague, you seem to be jumping from box to box. You say that she is a beaut in terms of presenting problem. You even comment on some of her comorbidity in terms of box 3. Then you say, wait until you meet her husband, and we're talking about the nature of the stresses. Then you say, oh, by the way, she has a long history of victimization, which is 4C, in short. There is nothing that you do for a living. Anytime you close the door and come out, you could summarize your session as falling into some distribution of these activities. If there's any merit to this, we, as a clinic, can ascertain the pattern, your decision-making, and moreover, as you look at the next page of the handout on page 9, this does not only have to be in your head, this is something you can actually share with the client. So, for example, I could say, Don, let me see if I understand what brings you here. Oh, look at that, he's starting off with box 2. And in addition, you're also struggling with, and every time I say in addition, that means that I am conveying to you, the client, box 3. And this seems to be made worse by, exacerbated by. Nicely done, Don. You're going for box 4. And for this, you receive what kinds of treatment? And they seem to work as evident by. Oh, nicely done, Don. You're now going for box 5A. And you had difficulty following through with, but you were particularly satisfied with, and in spite of, Don, are you telling me that in spite of all of that stuff in boxes 1 to 5, you, and every time you hear me say in spite of, you now know I'm working box 6. And of these different areas, Don, where do you think we should begin? So now I can work with you, the client, in collaborating on how we spend our time, and moreover, how would we know if we're making progress? What would we see change? What would other people notice? And Don, can I ask one other question, if I may? Can you foresee, can you envision anything that might get in the way that we can anticipate and address? Nicely done, Don. You're doing box 9. I, in my clinical practice, as well as in training people, see that this is a highly respectful, collaborative, non-judgmental, compassionate, trust-engendering style so that they could take my voice with them and develop transferable skills. We train clinicians and, moreover, even have a computer-generated report based on this. Last word. I would be more than happy to dialogue with anyone who hears this by having you email me at dhmeich, M-E-I-C-H, at AOL.com. dhmeich, M-E-I-C-H, at AOL.com. And I invite you to go to the melissainstitute.org/scientific/articles/by-author. So if you don't get a full with this now, I welcome you to scroll to Meichenbaum and see any of the follow-up. Once again, thank you for your attention and interest. And keep in mind that we intentionally put the music on so that you can understand the kind of interruptions that an addict has to experience. Open to any remaining time for questions, comments, reactions.
Yeah, I can keep the call open for a few more minutes if people have more questions and if you're willing to take them.
I just want to say that was the classiest way of handling a distraction I've ever heard. And I'm ordering your book on Amazon right now.
Thank you. My mother would be happy. No, I'd really be interested in people's reactions. I know we're cut off by time here and that we may have lost some along the way because of the interruption. So hopefully this will eventually be on the website. Do see the article that's online on how to spot hype in the field of psychotherapy. The field is absolutely filled with bullshit, and if I can help people become more critical consumers, that would be really an important goal for myself.
By the way, the call will be posted on the website, addictionpsychology.org, but it won't be posted right away because I'm having some mind glitches. But if anybody emails me, I will send you a link to it. I'm hoping we got the whole thing. We seem to have. So just email me, and I will get you the link to the call before it even gets posted. Listen, Dr. Meichenbaum, thank you so much. I appreciate it, and I apologize for the distraction, even though it's probably part it was scripted. And
well, thanks for the opportunity to present, and I look forward to people's response to the book that Rutledge is going to be presenting where all this is laid out in a non-musical fashion.
Thank you. Okay,
Take care, guys.
I will speak to all you guys in November and December for Dr. Cansey and Dr. Johnson. And everybody have a very good couple of weeks.
Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank all.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.